Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio Season 2. It is November 4th, 2006, and this week we have for you a special expanded edition of Benall of America Audio. What does that mean? Essentially, what it means is that this week's guest, Paula Harris, gave us such a lengthy interview that we were going to split it up into 2 weeks. But as fate would intervene, I will be in Las Vegas next weekend for the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4, and therefore we didn't really want to ruin the momentum of a great interview by breaking it up with a week hiatus in between. Plus, we really wanted to give you guys something to tide you over during that off week next week until we return on November 18th. What it all boils down to is expanded edition of Benall of America Audio this week, over 2 hours, the bulk of which is with this week's guest, Paula Harris, author of Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon. Paula Harris has done some amazing research. She has personal connections with many of the great names in ufology and really likes to take a big picture look at the UFO phenomenon that I can appreciate, plus puts an international twist on it, which is another one of my favorite aspects of ufology. So suffice it to say, I am a big Paula Harris fan, and I wanted to get her on the show for quite a long time, and we finally managed to get it done here for Season 2. Just to scratch the surface of what the interview is like, we're going to talk about Paula's early influences, J. Allen Hynek, Dr. John Mack, Colonel Corso, Monsignor Corrado Balducci, how she got into the UFO phenomenon, how her research evolved, some general big-picture observations of the UFO phenomenon, exopolitics, why Paula seems to be more interested in that realm than what you could call classic ufology. We also talk about Italian/European ufology versus its American counterpart. That's a fascinating discussion, and it's ongoing throughout the interview. It keeps coming back up as points that sort of sidebar off of our conversation. That's really just a brief overview of what to expect here in this edition of Benall of America Audio. Just a wealth of material and a ton of ground covered. Plus, following the Paula Harris interview, we have two additional segments at the end of the show. First, the debut of Benall of America Audio listener feedback. I was talking about this at the end of the show last week. This week it debuts. Definitely stick around for that. And then, after that, we've got an 8-minute-plus excerpt from the May 27th, 2006 edition of Benall of America Audio with Ryan Wood. Ryan Wood is part of the team behind the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4. He's going to talk about how the conference started, who will be at the conference next weekend in Las Vegas, and some of the stuff that they're going to be talking about. Definitely stick around for the end of the show to hear about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. That's where I'll be at next weekend. No Benall of America Audio next weekend. I will be on location in Las Vegas. We're going to talk more about it at the end of the show today. It's a jam-packed show. We've got tons of stuff. We've got the giant Paula Harris interview. We've got listener feedback. We've got the excerpt from Ryan Wood. Before we kick off the main course of this week's edition of Benall of America Audio, let me give you a little bit of background on Paula Harris for those of you who are unfamiliar with her. Paula Harris is an Italo-American photojournalist and investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena research. She is also a widely published freelance writer, especially in Europe. She has studied ET-related phenomena since 1979 and is on personal terms with many of the leading researchers in the field. From 1980 to 1986, she assisted Dr. J. Allen Hynek in his UFO investigations and has interviewed with many top military witnesses concerning their involvement in the government truth embargo. In 1997, Ms. Harris met and interviewed Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell, New Mexico, and became a personal friend and confidant. She was instrumental in having his book, The Day After Roswell, for which she wrote the preface, translated into Italian. She returned to Roswell in the summer of 2003 for the American debut of her book, Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon, published by Granite Press. Because of her international perspective on ET-related phenomena and her work with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, Paula has consulted with many researchers about the best avenues for planetary disclosure, with emphasis on the big picture and stressing the historical connection. Her website is www.paulaharris.it. Let me spell that for you. PAOLAHARRIS.IT. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on August 7th, 2006. Paula Harris on a special expanded edition of Been All of America Audio, Season 2.
Welcome to another edition of Been All of America Audio. I want to welcome as my special guest, Paula Harris. She is a investigative reporter. I like to call her a geo-ufologist because she really has her finger on the pulse of international ufology. It really impresses me a lot about that. And I had the distinct pleasure and honor of working with Paula Harris at the X Conference 2, where she had Monsignor Balducci with her, and Monsignor Balducci was giving the keynote address there. And if it wasn't for Paula Harris, I never would have got in the door to even meet Monsignor Balducci, much less interview him. And she could have been like, "Who are you, guy? Get out of here." But she was very welcoming and very helpful and opened the door for me. And I'm really psyched to have brought her to Been All of America Audio to talk about her work and her career as a researcher. And she's also the author of Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon. And her website is paulaharris.it, and that is spelled PAOLAHARRIS.IT. Paula Harris, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Tim. It's really a pleasure to be here, and it's great talking to you again.
Yeah, I'm really psyched. I wanted to get you on last year. It was so hard to touch base and stuff because you're flying all over the place and everything. So now that we're both having some downtime this summer, I figured it'd be great to have you on for the show for season two.
Well, I spend 9 months out of the year in Rome, Italy, as you know. It's a lot easier for me to work out of there sometimes. And then I spend 3 months of the year here in Boulder, Colorado. And while I'm here these 3 months, I run around the country a lot covering stories and doing conferences.
Yeah. Well, let's start out with your background, your bio. How did you become interested in the UFO phenomenon, and how did you begin your investigating career?
Well, you know, it's just all serendipitous. When I saw the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1979, I had an emotional reaction to the end of the film, you know, where François Truffaut meets, he greets the aliens. And all of that exchange brought a real emotional reaction. So I began researching the film, and I found out that Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was an astronomer at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, was a consultant with Spielberg. And what I decided to do was I needed to talk to him about what was in that film to see if it was really true. And so I was in Boulder, and then what happened was that I happened to be attending a wedding. This is where the coincidence part comes. In Evanston, and I stopped by the Center for UFO Studies. I don't know if your listeners know, but Allen Hynek was the head of Project Blue Book that was funded by the Air Force, and then he went out on his own and started CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I walked in the office, I never thought I'd see him, and there he was. I mean, he came out from around the corner with his pipe. His famous, you always see pictures of Allen with the pipe in his mouth, and he just came around the corner and asked me who I was, and I told him my background, and he wanted me to begin doing some Italian translations for him. So for 6 years, from 1980 to 86, while he was alive, I worked with the best of the best. He was my teacher, my mentor, and he took the subject extremely seriously, was a scientist, and I began to see that it was an international phenomenon. And that's how I got started. And then when I moved to Italy, people knew that I had worked with Allen Hynek, and they started asking me to write for magazines and to do investigations there.
Awesome. So you really got taken under the wing by, like you said, the best of the best in Allen Hynek. What was that like to really study under him, because he was such a giant in the field?
Well, it was great. You know, in my book, I talk about him because he was a very human person. You know, he basically loved opera. He read everything. What I didn't know was that he meditated a lot, that he thought the paranormal was connected with this. You know, I was just such a nuts and bolts person for such a long time. I mean, I've never seen a UFO, and I've never, had any kind of contact experience. So for me, I was like really skeptical, and I didn't believe all these people's stories. I used to go with him at places here in Denver, especially, to listen to people's stories, and I used to think they were crazy. And I used to say, "Do you believe that?" And I used to watch him, and he had such a wonderful way of dealing with these people. He never would make any comments. He was extremely compassionate. So I just learned from him just to listen, and, it was just it was just another world. It was a very professional, very compassionate, it was information gathering situation.
Yeah. And what, now, you were with him towards the end of his life. What was he thinking then as the UFO secret was still quite a secret, and was he disappointed? Was he hopeful for the future? Was he like, this is never going to happen? What kind of perspective did he have on that?
Well, he was really frustrated, and that's a good question, because I remember him at the end of his life. I mean, I remember him sitting down one day just looking at me and saying, I wonder if I'll ever know. I wonder if I'll ever, why don't they just come out with it? He says, I wonder if I'll ever know the truth before I die. I mean, he was very, very passionate about wanting to know what was going on.
And yeah.
I think he had bits and pieces of it, and I guess that's the whole deal. And my book is like that, because it's 26 interviews of top-level people, you know, everybody
yeah.
from Linda Howe to David Icke. And what I thought when I was putting the book together is, can people just put the scene together? Can we just figure it all out? It's a big puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And another very important person that you became affiliated with was Colonel Corso. And you seem to have developed quite a bond with Colonel Corso. So can you talk a little bit about him? Because a lot of people have heard of him, and a lot of researchers maybe have met him before, but you spent a lot of time with him, and you and him were really good friends. So talk a little bit about Colonel Corso some.
Well, you know, Tim, the thing is, there's another coincidence. Everything's serendipitous. Well, when I had to cover the 50th anniversary of the Roswell, crash in 1997, I didn't have a place to stay in Roswell. I came in from Italy. I flew directly in from Italy. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know what Colonel Corso looked like. I didn't know anything about the book. I knew nothing. I just knew I had to get this story and send it to my boss right away. I was writing for Notiziario UFO at the time. And I went into the press office and at the museum there, and I asked. I said, well, where can I stay? And they said, well, there's no place here, but if you want to look in the phone book. And I opened up the phone book, and I put my finger on the first place, and it was the Sally Port Inn. And I called them, and by miracle, they had a room for three nights, which is what I needed, and the room was right next door to Colonel Philip Corso.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, right there, I began looking at, I didn't know it until I got there, and then I had gone to the press conference, and you know, I got to speak to Corso, and he looked to me and he said, you know, my whole history is in Italy. He said, I basically was the head of intelligence in 1944 to 46, and I called my boss in Italy, and he said, invite him. So when I met Colonel Corso, not only did I have a chance to get an exclusive interview because everybody wanted one, but he was right next door. So he came in, he knocked on my door at about 7:30 in the morning, and I could get this interview.
Yeah.
Because it was right there.
Yeah.
But then I was able to invite him for a major conference in Italy where I think he did the most talking. Now, in Italy, he came twice, and the deal was that he would come with his grandchildren and his daughter-in-law, and so when he would come, he wanted to show his family where he worked during World War II,
mm-hmm.
and he was thrilled to go back to Italy and bring his family. And so, you know, the personal life I had with Corso was he would bring his grandchildren and his daughter-in-law, and we would go around Rome. We would go to restaurants. We would talk, and he even showed me where his office was in Piazza Venezia when he was head of intelligence. Now, he would tell me a lot of stories that were real. He could show me the places. I realized I was talking to a man who was telling the truth, and he was telling the truth also about the back engineering of the Roswell artifacts. And what shocks me the most is the lack of coverage that was done on the Corso story, because The Day After Roswell, for me, was the single most important book that has come out in the last 50 years from a very credible person talking about the fact that not only, yes, there were UFOs, but yes, there was a crash, and yes, there were bodies, and yes, there were artifacts. And so when we were, you know, together that time and in the next year in 98 when he came back for the conference, the international conference at San Marino, which is located, you know, near northern Italy, that time I spent Easter with him and was able to talk to him at length. What Colonel Corso has to say is ever so important and ever so real. If people would really understand this. There would be no more ridicule. There would be looking at this thing seriously, and people would be able to connect a few dots. But what happens all too often, and I got to say this, is when these whistleblowers or these people that are great testimonies come out,
yeah,
there's a lot of debunking going on in this country. We don't do that in Italy. I mean, there's none of that because we met Corso. He was passing out, all kinds of documents to different people, doctors and people who would come and see him. He would discuss things in detail. And so many people met him. None of those people ridiculed him. None of those people debunked him. And he was of great interest to all the people that met him. It's a completely different kind of atmosphere here in this country.
Yeah, and what do you, and since you knew him so well and you had a lot, a chance to talk to him at length, what do you think of the Corso critics that exist here in America? How do you respond to them? Because, you know, there's a lot of them, and they had that feature on him on the History Channel where they sort of tried to debunk him, and how do you feel about all that, the overwhelming criticism and investigation into Corso that goes on here, sort of very cynical look at him?
Well, that's a good word, cynical. The whole UFO phenomenon here is cynical. It's a big joke. I mean, in our conferences in Europe, it's filled with scientists, from people from the space agency, from people who are writers, just all kinds of people that are serious. Nobody laughs. And everyone has an intelligence symposium there, a discussion, a kind of scholarly kind of thing. I've been watching the television here, and I've been watching the History Discovery Channel. I mean, it's almost like the rule. You have to show the evidence, and then you must get at least four debunkers.
Yeah.
It's half of one and the other half of the other. Now, that keeps the people in total confusion. If that is what's supposed to happen, if people are supposed to be kept in total confusion, they've succeeded very well, and I have seen the program on Colonel Corso. He would be appalled, because one of the problems with Corso is that since it's a book from Roswell, a lot of the debunking goes on because I really believe that commercially the UFO field is about also competition in books, competition in relating things.
Yeah.
And the people that tend to debunk, if they were scholarly in their approach, all the Roswell people should have sat down with them and exchanged stories. Everybody that's written a book on Roswell should have been in one room exchanging their ideas, their stories, and their research. That would have brought the secret out. Not that you start debunking Colonel Corso without ever having a conversation at length with him. What appalls me so much about the researchers are when they go to debunk, they don't know the people. They just haphazardly throw out statements, and they do not meet these people. They do not have conversations with these people. And since Colonel Corso is no longer with us, he's dead. He can't even defend himself. So, you know, I find myself, since I speak about him at conferences, I find myself confronted with the people that are trying to look for the truth, that are listening to the icons of ufology, spout what they think is the truth. And I would like, to end this, I would like to say, people are intelligent. They should read everybody's testimony. They should read everybody's books. And they should form their own conclusions without being told what to think by other people who have their own motives. It's one mass confusion with these debunkers.
Yeah. And as far as Colonel Corso's book, now, did you say there was an Italian version of the book that was different from the American version, or am I confusing this story at all?
No, you're right. Actually, The Day After Roswell was co-written by Bill Burns. William Burns, and it was rushed, and his son said this was rushed for the Roswell opening there, and his son said at a conference recently that the colonel didn't even get a chance to look at the manuscript before it came out. So there's a few inconsistencies when you're writing with a ghostwriter, when you're writing with someone else.
Yeah.
when Colonel Corso came, so whatever little tiny inconsistencies there are, the Americans have made a heyday of it, a field day of it. But we translated the book into Italian. We had the contract to do that. I wrote the preface for it in Italy. And we had from Colonel Corso, diverse documents he brought over. And he brought over his notes for another book, his original notes, which is called The Dawn of a New Age. And so my boss, Maurizio Baiada, who appeared at the Laughlin Conference this year speaking about Colonel Corso, he published the book, Dawn of a New Age, in Italian, and you can find it in any bookstore. And those are his original notes. Nothing has been written by anyone else. It's much more detailed. It goes into a lot of what was happening in that time because, you know, Colonel Corso, we all know this, believed in two things. He believed in time travel. He thought the aliens from Roswell were us from the future. He believed in time travel, and he also believed in the fact that the jumps in technology have been alien-driven. Now, these are two mass ideas. These are two incredible, theories or facts. And if anybody was doing a scholarly study of this, they would actually start researching in that direction. The time travel and the back-engineered technology.
And is there something holding back the translation of that other book into an English version?
I'm not going to go into detail about that because it's such a confusion. I can't go into detail because it's an up-and-down situation with the Corso holdings and the reason why it won't come out. One of the things that I will add is that Jaime Maussan, thanks to intervention from me, he had seen the book, and he'd seen the Italian book. You know, Spanish is just really close to Italian. Mm-hmm. And he basically has bought the rights for the Dawn of a New Age for all Spanish-speaking countries. Now, Italy has it. Spanish-speaking countries has it. It's not here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, will it be here? I don't know. But even if it's here, I'm waiting for the debunkers to come out of the closet. I mean, it's the thing about the UFO phenomenon that we're looking at that's very discouraging for us serious researchers is you can have all the sightings in the world. You can have all the whistleblowers in the world. You can have all the real material. Even Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14, who's a friend, says he believes that there are UFOs and has spoken about Roswell cover-up. I mean, you can have all the verification, and people are still going to have this confusion in their minds. I'm convinced that I don't even know if the public really wants to know.
Yeah. And another key figure who you were very good friends with and you spoke at length about at the X conference was Dr. John Mack. Talk a little bit about him now, if you can, and what your friendship and relationship with him was like, and your thoughts on his passing and how big a hole that leaves in the UFO field.
Oh, Lord. I mean, we all love John, all of us. There isn't anybody that I ever met that didn't love Dr. John Mack. He had what Alan Hynek had. He had a sense of listening and compassion that was just beautiful, and people would tell him everything. Now, John Mack came to Italy because I sponsored him for a conference in Florence, and I honestly can tell you that I don't touch the contact scenario that much because I'm not good at it.
Yeah.
And I deal mostly with military and intelligence whistleblowers with looking at the putting together other people's situations. Mm-hmm. But John was heavily into the contactees. He never looked at it as abductions. He would talk about contact because he did say to me, and we had this conversation at home in Rome because he also was a guest in my home. I have an apartment near the Vatican, and we'd sit there and he would say to me, Paula, it looks like that the abduction scenario, the one that where the Greys, take people and so forth, has really fallen off. And what's happening more, he says, I'm getting more people that are coming into the office that have direct downloading contact. In other words, in their dream state, they get information directly rather than being taken. In other words, downloading.
Yeah.
And he said even with younger people that they come in and, you know, they get these ideas and they're directly downloaded. He didn't look at it as a scary situation. He looked at it as a heightening of psychic ability. And he talked about that at Florence. He also said in Florence that our problem was that we looked at what we thought was a paranormal as strange, whereas Eastern cultures thought that was the normal. In other words, we had to change our world view about the way we looked at different realities, about the way we looked at a different kind of scenario that we couldn't, that would for other cultures was very normal, the Aborigines, the Native Americans, and so forth, we thought was super strange. And, you know, Colonel Corso had somewhat of the same idea. He said we need to invent a new science to explain the UFO phenomenon, not try to shove the UFO phenomenon into the old science,
yeah.
Which is, you know, logical. I mean, that's just logical. And as far as John, you know, his death, you know, when we were in Florence and we were walking around and he wanted to see the Piazza, De La Signoria and different places. He's like an absent-minded professor. He was like walking off the sidewalk, so I was like pushing him back on. And he was like so enthralled. I took photos of him as he was looking at all the statues and so forth. I really believe it was an accident. I do not believe John was killed in it, or there's any mystery about that. I think it was unwise that he was walking around at 10:30 alone. I mean, he was never alone with us. I was always with him, or somebody was with him. And, you know, it's unfortunate at 10:30 he's walking around alone, especially when you have to look in the other direction because they drive in the other direction and then it was a drunk driver. So I mean, the driver was drunk to begin with, and then the fact that you have to look both ways, but in the opposite direction. I think that it was a very unfortunate accident. A lot of us that knew him had a hard time with it, mm-hmm. being a hard time with it because he left an incredible void. And I've noticed just recently, even on some documentaries, I mean, ridiculous statements like, this is REM sleep paralysis. John would have been out of his mind if he heard these kinds of explanations for the contact scenario. He did too much work, and Bud Hopkins has done too much work. David Jacobs has done too much work to be explained by sleep paralysis, the most ignorant thing I've ever heard in my life. Even in the people that are working in this area in Italy, we have a lot of, psychologists will never, ever use that as an excuse for what we call a contact or abduction scenario.
Yeah. Another person I want to talk to you about, we had already sort of talked about him earlier, was Monsignor Corrado Balducci. You, you were sort of his minder at the X conference too, because he doesn't speak very good English, if at all. So talk a little bit about Monsignor Balducci. Like I said, you opened the door for me to speak with him. It was a great thrill for me as someone who's new to the field to get to meet such a legendary figure as Monsignor Balducci. And you, of course, are good friends with him. So talk a little bit about him and your friendship and how you guys, came to know each other over the years.
Well, he loved meeting you because you're young. I mean, the young people need to get into this field. And when he saw you, he was thrilled to be with you. I mean, he even said to me, it's so wonderful that young people are doing this kind of research. Because Monsignor Balducci is in his 80s. In fact, I was talking to him on the phone the other day, and he goes, you know, I'm going into my 84th year. And it was a little hard, like you said, because, you know, he had to do a 15-hour plane ride, from Italy, and, you know, mostly in a wheelchair. And it was a miracle that we got him to Washington. He was papal nuncio to Washington, D.C., which is like the ambassador, kind of a representative from the Vatican, and I think it was in the 70s. So he was real excited to come back to Washington, and he's a friend because he lives down the street. I told you I live near the Vatican, and with the Monsignor, he really wants to know a lot of information. He has incredible archives. He has incredible library. He has incredible. He saves every article, every magazine that has to do with the this phenomenon and the paranormal, because, you know, Monsignor Balducci's books are mostly on the paranormal and the devil.
Yeah.
And he's been very important to come out, even on Italian television, Spanish television, saying, no, this is not the devil's work, because the devil doesn't need UFOs. He said, the witness testimony is so powerful, he said, in this field, that if they were in a court of law, and we actually come to conclusions with a jury in a court of law based on witness testimony. You know, people are condemned let go or released based on witness testimony. Monsignor Balducci said, I don't understand why somebody isn't taking this witness testimony seriously. It is the most important part of this phenomenon. The witnesses are credible. They know what they saw. And then the other thing that's so important, he said, it is not against the Catholic religion to believe that God created other planets and other universes to give glory to him, to himself. And he said in the Bible that Jesus is called King of the Universe 66 times. Actually, that whole title, and that title, King of the Universe, implies other universes,
yeah.
I mean, other galaxies.
Yeah.
And he said he talks about this, he said human beings are the ones that are the low rung on the ladder because they're still warring, as we still know we have conflict. He said they know what good is and they do evil. He said these beings have surpassed this period of primitive, evolution and are able to come to visit this planet, so we must be on the low, part of the scale of evolution. So he thinks he has a certain admiration. He sees it as a benevolent or benign presence, and it says, and it's very important for the Mexican, especially the Mexican or the Spanish-speaking countries, because Jaime Maussan, videotaped Balducci when he was at the X conference, because they're the ones that are having all the sightings right now. I mean, massive sightings over Mexico City of 200, orbs, 200 UFOs. I mean, these poor people, they're confused. So when Jaime Maussan filmed Monsignor Balducci saying it's okay, it is not against your religion to look at this phenomenon as something serious, it really helped.
Yeah. Obviously, you've talked to a ton of big names, and you know a lot of people in the field. You've done an amazing job of networking and drawing these people together. The last of the people I want to talk to you about before we move on to other subjects was Clifford Stone. You talked about him a lot at the X conference in your second presentation, and you sort of talk about how it's been tough for him as a whistleblower to get into the field of ufology, because the way ufology always seems to turn on the whistleblowers. Talk a little bit about Clifford Stone's story and his reaction to the way ufology turned around on him.
Well, Tim, you know how I want to do this. So I want to talk about the Disclosure Project, because I work with Stephen Greer on that. I mean, Stephen Greer for me is one of the single most powerful researchers that has really brought forth real military witness testimony. And he came to Italy, and I helped him with, we had a lot of pilots that he videotaped. We had military people he videotaped. And the Clifford Stone piece that I showed was from the Disclosure Project. Clifford, that's the only time he's ever come public, really, where he was videotaped. Clifford Stone, and I know his story because I went there to visit him in Roswell. He lives in Roswell. In fact, during the 98 Roswell convention there, I was invited to Clifford Stone's house. A lot of people were, because he has a lot of documents there. And the only people that took him up on this invitation was me and Victoria Pacaccini from Brazil. And it's really weird, because the only two European or foreign journalists are at Clifford Stone's house looking at all the material he has.
Yeah.
And all the other guys are out there just, I don't know what they were doing that night. They all got the invitation, but nobody went there. And we went to his home, and we saw filing cabinets full of crash retrievals in different countries. His job was basically to be on he thought it was a nuclear biological unit, to do cleanup of nuclear, nuclear accidents.
Yeah.
That's what he thought. But in 1969, his first case was Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. He even named the place. And what he thought was an airplane crash, he said he saw was a crash saucer that was in part of a hill. And he was sent. He thought they were following him, all his group, but he realized at a certain point he was alone, and he was told with a Geiger counter to go close to the crash saucer. Now, he saw dead entities in that crash saucer. He talked about that. But the reason why Clifford Stone did, you know, he told me around 8 of these crash retrievals was because when he was very young, he had his own ET experience, his own contact experience, and he somebody knew about that. So they asked him, and he wasn't even qualified to join a special unit in the Army. And so, you know, at a very young age, you know, he said 16 or 17, he enlisted, and his ability to telepathically communicate was what they were using. And that this idea of telepathically communicating, it has really fallen over into an awful lot of my stories in connecting the dots. I mean, Dr. Michael Wolf Cruvant also had a contact experience. He also did remote viewing and telepathic ability, just like Clifford. And these people have this ability. So Clifford found himself, you know, being present because he telepathically could communicate with these beings.
Yeah.
And it was also part of the military. Now, he thinks that it's time that this come out. He thinks that it's time the disclosure come forth. It is, he, of course, somebody gave him permission to speak, otherwise the man wouldn't be, and somebody gave permission to Carso to write the book. Somebody gave permission for this disclosure. So what we need to look at, Tim, is there is a slow process, real slow, release of information in this field that's going to probably have to accelerate when we can't keep the secret anymore.
Now, you say that Carso got permission and Stone got permission. Did either of them ever really say who sort of gave them the permission to go public with their stories, or was that something that they didn't talk about?
Well, in the Carso's case, the deal was that they had all talked about it in the Pentagon when he worked, and it was the last one to stay alive, the last one to, you know, to be alive, which,
yeah.
And after General Trudeau died, Carso knew it was his obligation. He was the last one to be able to talk about the back engineering, because this is where he was, you know, dealing with.
Yeah.
Even though Carso had some contact experiences, because in my book, the first interview that he gave me in Roswell was about contact with an alien, and I didn't even print it because I couldn't. In my data bank, you know, because I'm so nuts and bolts, I said, I can't print this story. They're going to think he's crazy. So I waited until after Colonel Carso died to print the contact story. It's in my book, Connecting the Dots, about his contact with a being in Red Canyon, you know, where he was the head of the nuclear missile base there in New Mexico. And the thing is that what all these people have in common, a lot of these people have been contacted, then joined the military, then served some function. Now, if Clifford Stone wasn't allowed to talk, Clifford Stone wouldn't be talking.
Yeah.
Clifford Stone knows that he can't go over a certain point. I mean, there are questions that I have asked Cliff Stone, and he said to me point blank, I can't talk about that. And I say, fine, I have no problem.
Yeah.
Tell me what you can talk about. You know, I mean, there's a lot of the witnesses in my book that say, I can't go into that. And I find there's no problem. It's really not a problem. What is a problem is the people that really want to know the truth that are totally confused by the amount of debunking in this country.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a perfect segue, actually, to the next sort of set of topics I want to talk to you about. And that's ufology, American ufology as a whole. We'll get into Italian ufology in a little bit. First of all, let's just start out with, what's your perspective on the field of ufology today in America?
Well, Tim, you know, it's like I've been in this for like almost 30 years because of Alan Hynek and so forth, and I became very, very disillusioned. And what happened is I met Dr. Michael Sala, who is a college professor, and I myself am a teacher with a master's degree. And when Dr. Michael Sala began to do real research, I mean scholarly type research where the conversation was intelligent, where the research was deep, I began to go into the exopolitical field and met Alfred Weber from Vancouver, British Columbia, and those two men had written two books on exopolitics. And that kind of changed my whole view. I got out of the, you know, the, what I call a commercial ufology kind of situation where it's still a joke and, you know, the commercialization of the gray aliens with the T-shirts and the everybody runs around with the antenna, and it gets to be too much of a non-serious situation.
Exactly.
The exopolitical became much more serious for me, and I could fit in there much easier because the conversation and the seriousness of the topic in America, if we deal with it like that, fits my personality better. And then this year, I interviewed the ex-Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer. I flew to Canada and interviewed him, and that interview, for me, is it's just groundbreaking because what that deals with is a high-level political figure like the ex-Minister of Defense. And he was that position during the Kennedy administration. In other words, he was under, he was what McNamara was for America, Paul Hellyer was for Canada.
Yeah.
And he talks about not spending, you know, millions of dollars to support a military-industrial complex that wants to shoot at aliens and uses the word aliens and UFOs. And the man is not crazy. The man is very wise. The man has written six books on economics. He has done his homework. He is a top political figure. And when I did that interview, it was like, for me, a milestone. And his you know, courage to talk about, you know, this is a national security issue. And it is. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
As much as I don't believe necessarily that what's visiting is hostile, otherwise it would have done away with us a long time ago, because I don't think we're very well liked in the galaxy.
Yeah,
however, the fact that the man is talking about this ex-Minister of Defense is a serious, credible person, and we can have a serious, credible conversation, brought me into the field of exopolitics, and it took me away from the hokiness of, you know, the UFO, the way it's looked at here. Now, you probably want to ask me about Europe. Well, you know, nobody laughs there. We have conferences of 300 people. The people come in. Basically, they tape the conference. They take home the material, and they know about all the American whistleblowers. They know about Adamski. They know about Roswell. They know about everything. They do their homework, and they can quote times and dates. And it's like these people are really curious in Europe. The books that are written are great books, and the magazine we put out, Area 51, is actually sold on all the newsstands.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I write a column for Area 51, and people buy it, and it's not like, you know, fringe. You know, I've heard somebody say to me, oh, you know, ufology is fringe. Well, there's nothing fringe about national security issues.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing fringe about visitations from outer space that are real. I mean, there's nothing fringe about that. If there's nothing fringe about what happened in Mexico with those poor military guys that were on that plane and saw the 11 UFOs while they were on a drug bust, and they didn't. The government of Mexico releases that film footage. We see it on our 6 o'clock news. We see it at least four times. And because the government of Mexico wants the other governments to know that this plane, this jet, saw in the infrared, saw 11 UFOs that were going at high level speed, and they want help. They want other governments to come forth and say, well, do you have this problem? Because if you have this problem, then we can all sit at the table and discuss it intelligently. So we're looking at it as the 6 o'clock news, and we have our news guy who does not make fun of it, and he compares actually this footage, and we see the whole footage, 10 minutes, we see the whole thing. He compares it to Hasdalen in Norway. So already the man that's doing the commentary is intelligent. He can name other places where this is happening. Here, when I brought this footage here 2 years ago, 3 years ago, people had never seen it. It was never on the news. It was never on any channel. And they're going, oh, you're kidding. And I go, no, no, we saw this in Europe. I mean, this came from Mexico. This was released by the Ministry of Defense. This is not somebody's research film. The Ministry of Defense gave this to Jaime Maussan. So, you know, other governments like France that did the Cometa Report and Brazil that handed over files to A.J. Gebhardt, other governments are, like, really curious, and they would like to work together. And I know the economic community also had some questions on the UFO phenomenon that they're looking at taking seriously. Now, do people in America know this? I don't know. They're watching the History Channel and the Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
And they're getting so confused about what's out there that I don't know if they know this, you know?
Yeah. You were getting sort of disillusioned with the commercial aspect of ufology. Was it sort of like as you got deeper into ufology, you realized that the field isn't one big happy family like you thought it might have been before you got into it?
No, it's not one big happy family, and that's another problem. I mean, the backstabbing and the negative, you know, the people aren't working together. As I mentioned before, all the Roswell people should be working together, all the abduction people should be working together, all the people that are interested in crop circles should be working together and not trying to debunk each other.
Yeah.
Colonel Corso once said, we don't need to do any kind of suppression of the ufology. The ufologists are doing it by themselves, and that's true. You know, this is the way I feel. I respect everybody, and I really have everybody's interview in my book. People even that I don't agree with, their theory I interview them word for word, and it's in my book because I think all the material should go out there, and people should decide for themselves what they think. So I respect my colleagues. The problem is that I'm not sure what the intent is. If the intent is just to have a conference and sell a book and do, you know, like videos and then go home and forget it, then I can't do that anymore because it's too important a question.
Yeah.
I have to be in the activist part.
Mm-hmm.
And the activist part, after having met Paul Hellyer, the ex-minister of defense, is to teach a serious course. So Dr. Michael Sala has put together almost a college course on the history of ufology, on the history of the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm teaching two courses in that exopolitics list. And there's kind of a certificate that he's developed after that. And being a professor and you know, having it be something that scholarly really does attract me. So I've gone in that direction. I still do conferences in the United States, and I still bring a lot of material from Europe so people can see how people are treated in Europe. I've got to tell you, people like Travis Walton was put on primetime television 40 minutes, and people thought it was perfectly normal. Nobody was scandalized. Nobody treated him badly. They were fascinated with the Travis Walton Fire in the Sky story, which, you know, is absolutely one of the best cases of abduction ever. And you know, it's just, I'm so used to the seriousness of which how we treat this phenomenon that's probably why I'm going in that direction.
Yeah.
You know, even though I just covered the MUFON conference here in Denver, and there was a passing of the baton from Schussler, an incredible, you know, researcher, mm-hmm. human being. John Schussler has been the head of MUFON for years, to James Carrion, who's a younger person, who is a very technical, he's a technical whiz who's doing a lot of good work categorizing and archiving all the MUFON files. So I covered that. I mean, I still do that kind of thing. And when I covered that, I sent that to Europe. I mean, I sent it all over so that everybody in Europe could see the changing, you know, of the guard for MUFON. And I covered the Hawaii conference where Alfred Weber, Paul Hellyer, Michael Sala, Wendell Stevens, and Ambassador John McDonald all were present at the signing of the peaceful declaration in space. In other words, there was a declaration made to whoever's visiting that on a citizen diplomacy effort, there will be no hostilities of shooting, you know, aliens out of the sky. We don't even know who in the world they are or where they're coming from or what the intent is.
Yeah. What's your perspective on being a woman in the field of ufology? Because it's traditionally a pretty male-dominated field.
Well, that's a good question, because it is hard. I mean, it's been really, really hard from the very beginning. In the very beginning, what was happening to me, even in Italy, was that I was doing all the work. In other words, I was doing all the field research. I was flying here, there, and everywhere, and I never spoke. In other words, all the material I was giving to the magazine, and my boss was printing it and so forth. It wasn't until Colonel Corso and a little bit later that I began to speak. In other words, from the first person point of view, that I was on the stage speaking about a story I had done.
Yeah.
And there's very few of us. I mean, there's Linda Howe and Essen Sekerara from Turkey, and it is difficult. I mean, it's a man's world, and I, you know, I've been told, well, you know, maybe you're getting a little too emotionally involved with your stories and this and that and the other thing. But, and I understand that. I do understand that. But I am one of those people that really encourages women in the field. Women are part of this phenomenon, and they have a different point of view sometimes. And also, I really think that, especially in the field of abduction and contact research, Yvonne Smith has become one of my very, very closest friends because I can't do that kind of research. And she has helped me a lot look at this, and she is a woman in the field also. And I think that it lends a lot. I mean, it does lend a lot. Linda Howe is one of the best of the best of the best. And she's done a lot of great work, and I know she's had a hard time. And you know, I think that the more that we do, the more that we come forth, the more that we speak, the better it'll be for other women in this field.
Yeah. And at the X conference, you kind of touched on this a little bit. Maybe you can expound on it some more. At the X conference too, one of the main focuses of your first presentation, and I dug out my old notes from over a year ago now. Back when we set up the interview, you urged for ufology to be more unified. Do you think the American ufology, they need really to draw themselves together more and end the turf wars and the infighting?
Yeah, I really believe that. But, you know, I think they can also pick up a phone. I mean, you know, when there's a story, you know, when there's a story happening in Europe,
yeah,
like the Milano sighting or something, you just pick up a phone and call and ask the people that are standing there or sitting there. And when, you know, when there's sightings in Mexico City, get on a plane and go there. And don't sit at home. And I heard this, and I couldn't believe I was listening to this. Don't sit at home and decide that what Jaime Maussan was looking at, all seven or eight films, was just balloons. I mean, I heard a prominent ufologist say, well, you know, they're not necessarily UFOs, and I felt like saying, did you get on a plane and go down there, and did you do your proper research? One of the problems, why people can't do field research, and why they don't pick up a phone, and why they don't call the original researchers, is, guess what? Money.
Yeah.
Everything that we do, Tim, is financed from our pockets. Mm-hmm. And these poor researchers don't have the money to go places, and they don't have the money to do the telephone calling and so forth, because it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're married or have a significant other and you're doing this work. A lot of the money goes out there, and a lot of the passion goes towards you know, the research and the looking for the truth. And it's very hard on families. It's very hard on people that aren't subsidized. I mean, can you imagine if this was taken seriously? I mean, I remember Alan Hynek saying to me, if going to the moon depended on volunteer work on weekends, we would have never gotten there.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the problem. It's money. So these guys, these people, the people that are doing a lot of the debunking too, are making these hypothetical, throwing out these hypothetical statements without ever talking to the people or going and researching the crop circle or doing any of it. And one thing that I will pride myself on is the fact that I have never done any story without flying there, without spending time with the witness, and without personally looking them in the eyes to see if they're telling me the truth and trying to do my homework properly. But it's cost me a lot of money. I mean, when I flew to Canada even to do the Paul Hellyer interview, that all came out of my pocket when I flew to Orlando, Florida, to do the interview with ground crew astronaut Clark McClellan. I mean, I had to go to NASA. I had to go to where Clark worked. I had to spend time with him before I even did his story. And I think that's, you know, the field research and that kind of research is the really good stuff. And it takes money.
And you talked a lot about the exopolitical movement. Do you think that that's where ufology is heading as a science into a more activist sort of area? Well, obviously you seem to think that that's where it needs to go, but do you think that that's where it's going to be going in the future?
If more people will think like that, I mean, we had a great group of people that, you know, like Wendell Stevens, like Robert Salas, who was the military gentleman who was in the bunker at Malmstrom Air Force Base when the missile, you know, when the missile shut down. I mean, we had people like, you know, good researchers and people like Paul Hellyer and everybody in Hawaii in June for that conference. Now, we were all impressed with Michael Sala, but Michael Sala is a newcomer to the field. And Dr. Michael Sala is pulling us into a scholarly kind of area. Now, he will be speaking at Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas in November. I think it's November 11th. And I'm so thrilled about that because Ryan and Bob Wood are the best researchers, among the best researchers ever. They're, especially Ryan and Bob Wood, are the very open-minded. And Ryan invited Michael Sala as Exopolitics to come to this Crash Retrieval Conference in Vegas. So he, you know, Exopolitics will be there in a regular UFO conference. And if these people all get together and they share ideas and it becomes, you know, a much more open situation, Exopolitics will be covered in all of the conferences in the United States. And you know, it's very important that they all work together. Ryan Wood's book, Magic 12, that just came out, I'm using it as a reference in one of my courses.
Yeah.
I mean, he's done so well. I mean, he does so much good work. So does his father. This is the way people should work. I mean, this book is incredible. I'm using it. I'm using that. I'm using glimpses of a new of other realities. Linda Howe's book. I'm using Alan Hynek's book. I'm using Alfred Weber's book. I'm using these people's work so that we can piece together this very complicated, really very mysterious phenomenon people call the UFO phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And you touched on it a little bit about, well, actually you touched on it a lot. The Italian ufology scene is a lot different from American ufology. And being Italian, maybe you can answer this question. What was the evolution of Italian ufology? Was it similar to the American ufology, or how has the ufology scene in Italy evolved from around the 1940s or so? You know what I mean?
Well, the first thing, I didn't realize this until I talked to Dr. Panavi, who's the head of, like, our MUFON, and he said that we had the Air Force, that Italy had an Air Force way before America. Mm-hmm. The Army Air Force became the Air Force in 1948, from what I understand. So, in other words, we had planes way before, you know, they were flying planes before America, and they began noticing anomalies. And during World War II, I guess they had UFO sightings both in Germany and Italy during the Mussolini era, and that there were some X-Files, you know, that came out, and he did a presentation on Laughlin on this during the Mussolini era. So it's a matter of national security. I mean, you can't get away from that. And so there's a lot of real serious files that were put away, and so these files are being archived, and they're being saved, and the researchers there, I think, in a way, are still kind of at the sighting stage and the archiving stage and the going to look at the physical traces cases and that kind of thing. We don't have any huge, Roswell situation in Italy. Everybody looks at the birth of ufology, the real birth of it, from the Roswell case, and so they know all about it. And I have invited this year Jesse Marcel Jr. to come to Italy because it's going to be the 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash, and it's going to be one big party. I know in Roswell, so it'll be this year. I mean, everybody will be there. It'll be the 60th anniversary, and so Jesse Marcel Jr., who actually handled the Roswell debris and has just written a book called Roswell Really Happened. I'm bringing him to Italy because then the people look at him as a historical figure.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't even question it. I mean, why would a man make up a story like that? I mean, he basically was an 11-year-old boy when his dad brought the pieces, spread them on the floor, tried to make sense of them. And so I just interviewed him here. Plus, he's coming to Italy for a conference. I mean, these people, they're just really curious in Europe. And,
yeah.
And look at it as a serious situation. I think that the Europeans also admired Alan Hynek. He went to Europe several times. And when we have conferences, we invite the French, the Belgium, people from Belgium, the Russians, Boris Chernoff, different people. And so we get an international picture.
Yeah.
Where it is here, I didn't see that many international ufologists at the conference here in Europe. I mean, in America, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And now here in America, we had the Project Blue Book and an attempt by the government to explain the UFO phenomenon. Was there ever an attempt over in Italy for that kind of scenario during the 50s, 60s, 70s type era?
Not that I know of. I mean, there may have been, but it wouldn't have been public.
Yeah.
There hasn't been an attempt looking at that, but there was an attempt back in around 1999 for the Italian government also to hand over and open up files for our MUFON organization, which is called the Centro Ufologico Nazionale CUN, to look at. And in other words, they came forward at one of the conferences and somebody, a military man, and said, yes, we do have these sightings. Yes, we'll tell you where they are. And yes, there are files. Would you like to look at them and so forth? Somewhat what happened to A.J. Gebhardt in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had our military cooperating with that. They're not afraid to use the word UFO. I mean, it's on the news, and we get it. They're not afraid to use the word unidentified, because the thing is unidentified.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't necessarily think it's little green men or aliens or whatever, but whatever's out there, That's we had a major sighting over the airport, Fiumicino Airport, of a green object. I mean, they were just reported it. There was a UFO over Fiumicino Airport, big deal. It's unidentified. It could be anything. Any more, though, Tim, in exopolitics, I've got this chapter in my new book that talks about our stuff or their stuff. A lot of the back-engineered, advanced technology is being identified as UFO, and it's our stuff.
Mm-hmm. What about UFO groups? Now, we had, NICAP form here in America. It was, some pretty high-level researchers, and then obviously APRO, and then MUFON. What about the Italian UFO groups? Whenabouts did they form, and what are, the main ones, and that kind of thing?
Well, the Centro Ufologico Nazionale, and that's a group, but that group doesn't allow for any other groups, and that's a problem, and that's still... That's a problem. It's always been a problem. It's been a problem, I think, here of the competition of groups, and it's a problem there. They don't officially recognize any other groups, and it's hard because that particular group is a group that's an older group that's been around for a long time, and there's some younger groups that have, the Gauss from Florence, and their Gruppo Accademico are from the university, and they've invited Ryan Wood to speak on November 19th. And that group, nobody in that group is over 32 years old.
Oh wow!
I mean, that's a young group, and there's this competition between the older group and the younger group, and it's hard because whenever you form a group, there's a mentality there.
Yeah.
I just personally, as a researcher, refuse to belong to any group, and I support all the groups.
Mm-hmm.
But groups are hard because it's we're humans, and when
yeah.
we get into the human thing, there's competition, there's debunking, there's all that stuff.
What's the attitude of the UFO community over there? You said they're pretty studious about the subject. It's not as commercialized here as it is here in America.
Look at it this way. Yeah, they're looking at a case of crop circle. We had a crop circle in Ascalipi Channel. So what happened is everybody just races there, and they start taking samples, and they start doing the questioning. And it's in the newspaper, and it's on the news, and nobody has any problem with it, and it's not censored. And if it's something that you know is not real, they'll even say that. And if it's something that's mysterious, they'll say that.
Yeah.
And when Jaime Maussan came with the Mexico City footage, I mean, it was on primetime Italian state television for 4 or 5 minutes. I've never seen Jaime Maussan on CNN or NBC or ABC. I mean, his film footage is astounding. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's real film footage. I mean, it gets better because he's asked people with video cameras to send him the footage, and he's like the 60 minutes of, he's a journalist. He's not a researcher. He's a journalist. He's got his own TV show. And so when he was on state television, and this is state television for 40 minutes, and everybody's watching his film footage, there was no problem. Nobody thought it was weird. Nobody called the station, you know, and people just thought about it. I think what happens when we allow less censorship of this kind of material is that people get to think about it. What it did is it kind of shook them up as to what is happening in Mexico. Is, you know, are sightings like warnings, or why are they here? And it helps people think a little bit. I don't think it was any danger to anybody. And you asked for the difference. The difference is primetime television and magazines on the newsstands and the ability to talk about it without anybody laughing or ridiculing or coming in with an alien costume.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I wish we had more of that here in America. And what about, like, the general public? Are they more accepting of the idea, or is the attitude similar to America?
Well, we're dealing with 2,000 years of history. So, well, you know what they do. I mean, everybody's doing this anymore. They're looking at history and ancient history and the artwork. I mean, on my website, I have something like a website that has 40 paintings of Renaissance artists that have UFOs in them.
Oh, wow.
And and the gentleman that has that website has done an incredible job. And then they go back and they go, well, did the Egyptians really build the pyramids? And what about the Sumerians? And what about Zachariah Sitchin's work on, you know, so they live in history because they're 2,000 years old. I mean, America is 200 years old.
Yeah.
A little bit over 200. And these people are 2,000. They don't think there's anything weird about, mystery of archaeology or archaeological, mysteries of any kind. So they're trying to, I think the average European is going, okay, well, if this is happening, how long has it been happening? How can we attach it to different cultures? In the Himalayas in India, for instance, they have UFOs going, they have lights going in and out of several mountains. I mean, they're looking at a mystical situation. The people from India were talking at one of the conferences, and they have film footage of these lights going in and out and of, you know, different places in the Himalayas. And people are going, okay, well, this is really old. This is all part of history. This is all part of archaeology. This is all, let's look at when this started. Let's look at what it might mean for history. I'm convinced that when we really find the truth, when disclosure really happens, we're going to have to rewrite every single history book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too. And being so close to the Vatican, are you hearing any change in the buzz coming from the Vatican with regards to the UFOs scenario, because especially with the change in the papacy?
Well, all I know is that Monsignor Balducci told me that the Pope was interested. He knew that Balducci was doing these shows. He knew that it was on television. I mean, he was on nationwide television.
Yeah.
And he said that he was curious. I think most people are curious. They're never going to take an official stand because the Vatican, like any other political structure, is a political structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religious structure, but it's also a political structure. They have an incredible observatory here. I think it's in Arizona.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of equipment looking at the stars. Everybody's looking at the stars. Everybody's looking at what's happening, in the cosmos. And so I think that everybody's talking, if they're interested in this kind of phenomenon, they're talking to each other. Whoever knows is talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And if disclosure is supposed to happen, they'll all agree when that's going to happen and what the date is and why and so forth. I just don't think you can keep hiding it forever, especially if regular human beings, if people are going to be going out into space commercially. I mean, if somebody like Bert Rutan is developing, you know, the White Knight space plane, and they're going to be taking regular people, what are you going to explain to them when they're looking at these vehicles that are out there? I am positively sure, and I've talked to astronauts about this, that they've seen UFOs in space. I mean, you can't tell the UFOs not to show up when people are out there, you know, in a regular commercialized plane. And in the next, you know, 50 to 60 years, we're going to be using commercialized planes to go to space, and so disclosure will have to happen. And the way that'll happen is, I don't think it'll be, unfortunately, from the top up. I don't think there'll be any announcement or anything, Tim. I think what'll happen is that everybody will just come to the conclusion that it was no big deal, and that, you know, with the television and with all the movies that are coming out, a lot of them were disclosure movies. Mm-hmm. I think Close Encounters was a disclosure movie myself. They'll just say, oh yeah, the next generation will say, oh yeah, no big deal. I mean, we've been visited by extraterrestrial civilizations, no big deal, and that's the way it's going to go. Nobody's going to get on the bullhorn or do an announcement on, you know, from the Oval Office. Nobody will do that. Yeah. That's not going to happen.